Flooding from Hurricane Florence, now a tropical depression, has spread across the southeastern U.S., resulting in at least 16 deaths, as much as 75 centimeters of rain with massive power outages, significant property damage. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper says the state will recover.
Eventually the skies will clear and the floodwaters will recede. And when they do, we're ready to take on the challenge of rebuilding our communities.
Heavy rain expected to continue in the region and beyond over the coming days. Typhoon Mangkhut, now a tropical storm, pushed into southern China on Sunday, killing two there after lashing the Philippines with strong winds, heavy rain that has left at least 65 dead, dozens more feared buried in a landslide. In the days ahead of the typhoon's landfall in the Philippines, officials had said the government was ready for the worst. Arthur Tugrade is Secretary of the Department of Transportation.
Many times in the past, there was just a reactionary approach. In the time of President Duterte, we are taught how to be proactive. In fact, so proactive that in my department, we started talking on how to address the situation as it occurred since Monday.
Thousands of residents in the path of the typhoon have fled to safety in the Philippines, but there are fears that no amount of preparation would be enough. More than 2.4 million people have been evacuated in China's southern Guangdong province. Eritrea and Ethiopia have signed an agreement, further bolstering relations between the two countries, which have been at war for 20 years. Eritrea, a former province of Ethiopia, broke away from its much larger neighbor in 1993. This is VOA News. UN Human Rights Office reporting street protests over the lack of basic services in Iraq's Basra governorate are escalating as the government fails to meet the population's rising discontent. UN Human Rights spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani tells VOA unidentified attackers also have infiltrated the protest with harmful intent.
There were many different parties involved in the violence, which is why we're seeing there's a need for independent investigations and accountability. At least 52 members of security forces were also injured. So again, clear need for investigations and accountability.
UN Human Rights Office urging the Iraq state to listen to the grievances of their people. The United States has called an urgent meeting of the UN Security Council today in response to what it says are efforts by some countries to undermine and obstruct sanctions against North Korea. VOA asked Harry Kasianis, Director of Defense Studies at the Center for the National Interest, if today's UN meeting will make any progress.
No, unfortunately not, that the whole idea of maximum pressure died. And it probably actually died the day Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un shook hands. When you have a visual like that, when you have, you know, the world press sort of going goo-goo and gaga over, you know, Donald Trump shaking this dictator's hand, that has a legitimizing impact.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has accused Russia of actively working to undermine international sanctions on North Korea and said the enforcement of the steps was essential to convince Pyongyang to give up its nuclear weapons. Media reports are indicating President Trump has instructed aides to proceed with tariffs on $200 billion more in Chinese products, despite Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin's attempts to restart trade talks with China. The United States has already imposed tariffs on $50 billion worth of Chinese goods. Christine McDaniel, a senior research fellow with the Program on the American Economy and Globalization at George Mason University, says there is not a lot of room for negotiation right now.
You have a president who is determined to continue to impose tariffs, who does not seem to give his U.S. negotiating team, largely, you know, Secretary Mnuchin, to lead the talks much room. Whenever he does, there's often a tendency for the president to tweet something that may contradict what or undermine what Secretary Mnuchin is trying to accomplish. So it's not really clear what the incentives for China really are, you know, in terms of coming back to the table.
Meantime, China has threatened to retaliate against any new tariffs, with the Trump administration arguing that tariffs on Chinese goods would force China to trade on more favorable terms with the United States. I'm Steve Norman, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, September 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. One of Rwanda's political prisoners speaks following her release.
You know that the last time Grenipat is now in the parliament and I am released, that is a good clue that the beginning opening political space in Rwanda. I hope so.
That's Victoire Ingabire of the band FDU Inkigi Party of Rwanda. Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission launches a campaign against illegal passport sale. A new report urges better allocation of aid in wealthier countries. Cameroon's government urges secessionists to lay down their arms as the so-called Ambazonian Republic declares a no movement in English-speaking region.
The purpose of the non-movement policy is to force La République du Cameroun, our neighbors, to stop its attempt to force an election on the sovereign territory, Ambazonia.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the so-called Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon, and Liberia's jail deputy minister is remorseful following release from detention. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Rwanda, freed political prisoner Victoire Ingabire says she hopes her release marks the beginning of a new era of political freedom in Rwanda. Ingabire, leader of the band FDU Inkigi political party, was among over 2,000 prisoners whose pardon was announced last Friday by President Paul Kagame. Eugene Uwimana reports from Kigali.
The decision to free Ingabire and the musician Kizito followed the cabinet meeting and came as a surprise to many Rwandans. Addressing the media following their release, both Kizito and Ingabire thanked President Paul Kagame for their freedom. Speaking in Kinyarwanda, Kizito Mihigo said the clemency reveals the other side of President Kagame. Allow me to start by thanking the President of the Republic for this decision of pardoning me, the decision that shows his heart force. Maybe may know his military force, but at this time, he shows his heart force. I believe that it is going to allow me to continue that task of mine since I was young of delivering the message of peace and unity. For her part, Victoire Ingabire described the pardon as the beginning of a fair political game in Rwanda.
There is a hope that there is the opening of the political space. You know that the last time Grenipat is now in the parliament and I am released, that is a good clue that it is the beginning of the political space in Rwanda. I hope so.
Some political analysts like Aime Muyombano, a lecturer at Université Libre de Kigali, share the same optimism as Victoire Ingabire. Muyombano described the pardons as a political and humanitarian act.
It's a good component, demonstrate or illustrate the humanitarian, specifically for the Rwandese. And two, it's demonstrate also that whatever idea you do have, what is needed is not having a different idea from yours, but what is needed it's those different ideas are from yours. Together, you can move forward the country and its community.
But Murangwa Foste Bismarck, an independent lawyer specializing in criminal cases, says no matter how free Kizito and Ingabire are, there are still some legal conditions they must meet.
First, the condition is not to commit any other crimes, because when you talk about the presidency mercy or pardon, it's not meaning that it changed the judicial record.
Ingabire was arrested in 2010 on allegations she was fundraising the FDLR, a terror group that the government said is linked to the 94 genocide against the Tutsi. Some of the evidence implicating Ingabire was provided to the Rwandan judicial authorities by the Dutch government. She was also convicted for inciting the masses to revolt against the government and minimizing the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi. She was sentenced to 15 years and has served 8 of the 15. Kizito Mihigo was serving a 10-year sentence after he pleaded guilty to crimes that included conspiracy to murder President Paul Kagame and other top leaders of the country. A total of 2,140 prisoners, including Gabriel Kizito, were beneficiaries of President Kagame's pardons. The prisoners came from different parts of the country, a majority of them, about 484, from Huye District. Ejene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali.
Cameroon's so-called Ambazonia Independent Republic has declared a no-movement policy in the English-speaking regions of the country between September 20th and October 12th. Cameroon is having a presidential election on October 7th. This comes also as the so-called Ambazonia is preparing to commemorate the first anniversary of the declaration of its independence from what they called French Cameroon. Chris Anu, Secretary of State for Communication of the Ambazonia Separatists, says there will be no movement of persons, vehicles, and motorcycles, as well as vessels within the nautical miles of Ambazonian waters. He says the group is urging those in the English-speaking region to stock up on basic necessities like food and water.
The purpose of the non-movement policy is to force La République du Cameroun, our neighbors, to stop its attempt to force an election on the sovereign territory, Ambazonia.
But are you affecting your own people by this policy?
Our own very people are very excited to get involved and engage in actualizing this policy because they know it is the only way to stop French Cameroon forcing an election on us and on them.
How do you enforce that?
We don't need to do anything to enforce it. We are basically telling our people there shall be no movement within the days that we have announced. We have also made it very clear to any election observers, whether from the African Union or from the AU or UN, any election observers who have made it so clear, we do not want them in our territory. We cannot guarantee security and safety for them. And to La République du Cameroun, we have said we do not want any vehicles crossing our border from La République du Cameroun in Douala, in Bavoussam, either to the southern zone or to the northern zone. We will bring down any helicopters flying over our territory to stop this election.
Let me say that I spoke with the Minister for Communication of the Cameroonian government, and he says that the territorial integrity of Cameroon is indivisible, that he's calling on you and your movement. There's still time for you to apologize so that you'll be welcomed back into the country.
Well, Mr. Chiroma has always been living in a dreamland. He still thinks that we are living in 2016 when we still consider ourselves having a relationship with La République du Cameroon. No, we are long gone, in fact. Next month, we mark it exactly 1 year that we declared the restoration of our country, Ambazonia. And so if La République du Cameroun, through its communication minister, still thinks we are thinking a bit, just a bit, to go back and live with them, then they haven't started the war yet. After all that they have done, killing our people like chickens, burning our towns and villages, we will never, never again go to live with La République du Cameroun. We would prefer to kill all of us than any one of us to go back and live with them.
Let me say that when I spoke, I asked the minister about the violence and the people who are fleeing the area. He blamed all the violence in the English-speaking region on your organization.
How can he blame the violence on our organization? In fact, we are not an organization. We are a government. And by the way, how can he blame it on us? Who declared war? They declared war. What we are doing is basically defending our families and defending our property.
Chris Anu is Secretary of State for Communication of the so-called Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon. He was speaking with me from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, September 17th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Cameroon's Minister of Information is urging the so-called Ambazonian freedom fighters to lay down their arms, apologize for their action, and be accepted back as citizens of Cameroon. Issa Chiroma Bakari says the territorial integrity of Cameroon is indivisible. His comments came as the secessionists say they have declared a no-movement policy in the country's English-speaking regions from September 20th to October 7th to disrupt the country's October 7th presidential election. Chiroma Bakari says the secessionists are daydreaming because the nation's commitment to remain united is unshakable.
I would like you to let them know that they are daydreaming. The unity of each nation is unquestionable. They are engineering the suffering. They are inflicting suffering. Happen what may, this is the message I keep conveying to whoever is ready to listen. Each nation will remain united. And if they can listen to what I am telling them, ask them to lay down their arms and to apologize and ask for forgiveness. It is never too late to understand that the suffering that they are inflicting to our people, really, they will bear the consequences. The commitment of this nation to remain united is unshakable, but it is never too late. Let them understand that it is never too late.
Minister, one of the issues they have complained about is the non-representation or marginalization of the English-speaking region. They are saying the election that is coming up should not be held in their region. They call you the French Cameroon not to have election in their territory.
They are comfortably settled in the United States and many other areas in Europe and in North America. In complete disregard of the suffering of our people, they continue to engineer suffering, havoc, destruction of property, preventing our children from studying. This is an unprescribed crime. They have to understand this. They don't have a territory. They didn't lose their identity. They are still Cameroonian. As I said, it is never too late. Let them lay down their guns and come back home and see the consequences of the action and act that they have inflicted to the people. As far as the presidential election is concerned, the election will take place. Up until now, they did not realize that their motto is not followed at all. They threaten people, they torture people, they prosecute people in order to compel them into obeying their motto. This is an indication that without violence, nobody can listen to what they are saying.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is Cameroon's Minister of Information. He was speaking with me from the capital, Yaoundé. A new report says aid money urgently needs to be redirected to the poorest countries in order to reach the United Nations goal of ending extreme poverty by 2030. The London-based Overseas Development Institute, or ODI, says middle-income countries receive more aid than the 30 poorest nations. It warns that at least 400 million people will still be living on less than $1.90 a day, despite governments pledging to eliminate all extreme poverty. Henry Richwell reports.
In northern Ethiopia, teams of workers dig irrigation channels through orchards and grain fields. Projects like this have turned arid plains into fertile farmland, and agricultural production has quadrupled. The report from the ODI credits Ethiopia's so-called Productive Safety Net program, launched in 2005, with lifting 1.4 million people out of extreme poverty. It enabled Ethiopia to avoid another famine during severe droughts in 2010 and 2015. In contrast, neighboring Uganda has recently seen extreme poverty levels rise, despite a rapid reduction in previous years. Marcus Manuel is author of the ODI report.
And one of the reasons is because climate change is starting to have an impact in that country. Now, in Ethiopia, they've managed, with a lot of support, partly from the US, to have programs that support farmers when the sudden climate and a weather event happens. Uganda, they didn't. So when they had a drought, and when that led to real increase in poverty. So it's a matter of having the right systems in place.
Ethiopia's program, the largest of any low-income country, pays beneficiaries to work on public works projects like irrigation, roads, schools, and health clinics, helping to create long-term poverty relief. Such programs are vital in ending extreme poverty, according to the ODI report, which says there is an annual funding shortfall of $125 billion in the three core sectors of education, health, and what it terms social protection transfers, or welfare.
You need to do economic growth to do part of things, and then you also need investment in the social sectors. You need to have both sides of the coin to make this work. The donors are investing both in growth and in the social sectors, but they're not investing it in the right countries to near the extent that's needed. And in particular, in this report, we've identified 29 countries which can't afford the investment needed in the social sectors, and donors are not giving enough money to that group of countries.
The statistics are striking. Middle-income countries receive more aid than poorer countries, whose share of global aid has fallen over the past 6 years from 30% to 24%. As well as better aid allocation, the report says more donor nations need to reach the UN goal of allocating at least 0.7% of GDP to aid budgets. Without urgent action, the authors warn the goal of eliminating extreme poverty by 2030 will remain out of reach. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The chair of Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission says his agency has embarked on a new mission to crack down on those who traffic in falsified Sierra Leone diplomatic passports. The passports have been sold for as much as $7,000. Francis Ben Kaifala says the purpose of the campaign is to restore credibility into the country's passport process so that those who have them will be deserving of them.
We had received information that there were diplomatic and service passports in the hands of people who were undeserving of it. And we launched covert operations to first of all understand the process of them getting it. And we launched an operation called Operation Eagle Claw that arrested many people.
This process, did it begin under the government of President Ernest Bai Koroma or under both Koroma and Julius Mada Bio's government?
We have not been able to establish a clear cutoff point as to under what government or regime this has been happening, but we believe it's been going on for a very long time. So we are trying to take steps to restore credibility into the system and to bring respect to our passports and documents to make sure those who have it are deserving of it.
Did your government get complaint from the U.S. Embassy in Sierra Leone that might have led to this investigation?
No. In fact, we launched our investigations. We arrested dozens of people. The former head of the immigration was declared wanted by us using Interpol because he's in hiding as we speak. And the U.S. Embassy then got interested and they contacted us.
The report I read said that these passports are sold for as much as $7,000 for each. So who is buying the passports?
It's people who are desperate to travel to the U.S., people who are desperate to travel to U.K., people who are desperate to travel to Australia, people who just want to go seek greener pasture elsewhere. So these cartel of people who take this money from them and help them go through the process of firstly getting the passport, and then after they get the passport, they then help them get the visa. And many people have traveled like that already. Already by our investigation, we have names of people who have left the shores, who have traveled to different countries using service passports that were not really properly issued to them because they were started by people who had motives for applying for them.
Francis Ben Kaifala is the new head of Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission. You're speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. Liberia's Deputy Information Minister for Press and Public Affairs, Eugene Fangon, was on Friday released from jail after spending 2 nights in police cell. Minister Fangon was ordered detained by the House of Representatives for disrespect to two lawmakers.
Well, I feel great. I'm honored to be out and again, it was a sad moment for our country, but we're happy that we all are one people and we're going to hug and make up and we move on.
How did you feel when you received a huge applause from some of your supporters that turned out at the police headquarters today?
I felt good. It means that despite all of our shortcomings, there are still people who believe in us. And once they believe in us, to err is human, to forgive is divine, But what's most important is the fact that we move this nation forward.
You said to Ernest Hyman, you just had a news conference. What exactly were you telling the Liberian people?
I was apologizing to the Liberian people for my overreaction. I overreacted to a situation that should not have happened in the first place. And that's what we do when we err. No one is perfect. I think I could have handled it a better way, but I did not. And therefore, I owe the people an apology, which I have done. I owe my president an apology, my vice president an apology, my colleagues in the cabinet, and all other well-meaning people.
Eugene Fangon is Liberia's Deputy Minister of Information for Press and Public Relations. He was speaking with reporter Moses Gaziowu in the capital, Monrovia. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin in Berlin, where Kenyan runner Eliud Kipchoge has set a new world record, winning the Berlin Marathon in 2 hours, 1 minute and 39 seconds.
Raises a sprint on those magical legs, and at last the world record is his. How fitting is this? The Olympic champion is the world record holder. 2:01:40, unofficially there for Eliud Kipchoge.
The Olympic champion broke the record set by fellow Kenyan Dennis Kimeto in 2014 by 1 minute and 18 seconds. The 33-year-old is widely seen as the greatest marathon runner of the modern era. He has won 10 of the 11 marathons he has competed in and also won Olympic gold at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics in 2016.
But I had to believe and I was really ready to go Berlin. I had to push by my own. I always say Berlin forever. I will come back next year.
In the women's category, it was another victory for Kenyan athletics as defending champion Gladys Cherono won the women's race in 2 hours, 18 minutes and 11 seconds, setting the new women's record for the course in Berlin.
My target was to break the course record of today, to run under 2:19, my personal best, and also to run 2:17, but the last 2K was really hard for me. I was so exhausted, and I am happy to run my personal best today.
Uganda is set to meet Commonwealth gold medalist England in the group stage of the 2019 Netball World Cup Championship, following the draws that were held in Nottingham at the weekend. The Netball World Cup is scheduled to take place in Liverpool in July 2019. Rashid Mumbiru, the She Cranes coach, and Ruth Meme, a She Cranes senior player, share their thoughts on the draws.
The grouping of World Cup, the group is not so easy, but I know Uganda will go through in that pool.
England, we played it in a Commonwealth. We played Scotland in a Commonwealth. We played Samoa friendly in 2015 World Cup. So it's not a very hard group, and I'm very sure that we'll get out of that group and get to the quarterfinals.
Finally, in basketball news, Nigeria and Tunisia men's basketball teams became the first two countries to officially secure qualification for the 2019 FIBA Basketball World Cup in China. Nigeria's D Tigers secured their spot with a comprehensive 114-69 victory over the Central African Republic and securing an 89-61 victory against Senegal in Lagos. The Tigers coach is Alex Umora.
We've been trying to make sure that every game we play, we give it our best, especially playing in front of our home crowd. I really appreciate the support from Nigerians all over.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sport. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, September 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a good day.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we'll have an exclusive interview with Melinda Gates, co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.